Well, we are continuing this morning with our study through the book of Job, and today we'll be looking at the beginning of the third test that came into Job's life, which begins in Job chapter 2, verse 11. Before we get to that verse, I need to just make sure we remember the context so we know what's happened to this point. Help us understand what's happening now. From the very beginning of the book, Job is clearly identified as a righteous, blameless man who fears God and turns away from evil. The Lord actually points out Job to Satan. And Satan begins to accuse Job, saying that the only reason Job even serves the Lord is because the Lord has built a hedge around him and won't let anything bad happen to him or to the things that he owns or to his family. He says if bad things were to happen to Job, then he would curse you to your face. God gives Satan permission to test Job, and this is the first test that Job experiences. And as a result of this test, all of Job's livestock, which was many, were taken, stolen. Nearly all of his many servants were killed. All 10 of his children were killed at the same time. But in spite of all this, Job continued to bless the Lord and trust him. After this, God once again points out to Satan what a righteous man Job is. Continues to be a righteous man in spite of what Satan has done. Satan again accuses Job and says, well, God, if you would let me take away his physical health, you would let me touch his body, then Job would curse you. Once again, God gives Satan permission. And so the second test of Job takes place when Satan smites Job with boils and loathsome sores, as they're described, from the soles of his feet all the way to the crown of his head. And still, though, Job continues to hold fast his faith in the Lord, even when his wife unwittingly becomes a mouthpiece for Satan herself and counsels him to curse God and die. But once again, he holds true. Now, at this point in the book, Satan never shows up again. You never hear anything about Satan in the rest of the book of Job. But it's at this point that Job's third test begins. And there are several aspects of this third test, because the third test takes us all the way through another 40 chapters or so. So several things about this test that we'll see. We won't see all of this today, but we'll begin to see these aspects of this third test. And obviously, just by the fact that it's so prolonged, that tells us that his physical and emotional pain is going to continue for a prolonged period of time. So the test, the things were done, but now he has to endure that for a prolonged period of time. That's where his third test comes in, the length of that. Secondly, we're going to see that he has to endure friends who are not very understanding and not very helpful. And thirdly, we're actually going to see Job wrestling with God and with the purposes of this suffering. And actually, we see that begin to happen today in what we're going to look at. So let's begin this morning by looking at the beginning of this third test. And point number on your outline is this. Job's third and most prolonged test begins with the coming of three friends whose intention is to comfort. So let's look at Job chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, and they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. Each of the three men mentioned likely had some connection with Abraham's extended family. Now, they were not part of the covenant people of God. Job himself was not part of the covenant people of God as far as the nation of Israel is concerned. But they do seem to have some. These people seem to have some connection with Abraham's relatives. For example, Eliphaz is descended from Teman, who was actually the grandson of Esau, and Esau was really the grandson of Abraham. Bildad apparently came from a place known as Shua, and Shua was Abraham's son by his wife Keturah. Zophar is also thought to be a descendant of Esau, so they probably came from the area known that came to be known as Edom. Now, these men are obviously very important to the story. I mean, by far, the conversations between these three men and Job take overwhelmingly the majority of this book. Another 35 chapters or so are going to be conversations between Job and these three men. So they are not insignificant at all to what God wants to teach us through this book. Now, there's two important things I want to recognize about these three men, especially here in these early verses. First one is this: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar were all eminent friends, eminent men who were friends of Job and came of their own accord to stand by their friend. Job was described back in chapter 1 as being the greatest of all the men of the East. But these three men were very important in their own right. And really, even some of the things that are said here, but as we get kind of insights into who they are later on in the book, we see that they were older than Job. And, of course, especially at this time, with age comes great respect. They were wise men. They were very learned men. They were men of good reputation. They were the kind of men that people deferred to their judgment. And so these three very important men heard about what had happened to Job, and they made an appointment together to come and sympathize and empathize with Job, to comfort him. Job didn't ask them to come. They came of their own accord. And they obviously considered Job not just to be an important man. I think overall they considered Job to be a friend. And that's why they came. They came because he was their friend. And they heard about what had happened to him. And just the very fact that they came, I think, speaks very highly of them. I was trying to think, you know, if we try to make a list of people in the world in this time who were, you know, have a high stature, very important, you know, places of importance that they serve and that kind of thing, to think of any of them doing anything even remotely similar to what these three men did for Job, just to come and do what they did, to take time out of their responsibilities, I mean, I can't imagine that happening. So just the very fact that they would do what they did with the intention of encouraging their friend, I think speaks well of them. So, and keep in mind, these were eminent men who, of their own right, had great stature, and they, by their own accord, came to stand by their friend. Secondly, we notice this. Job's friends demonstrated a tender empathy toward Job in his suffering. We have to assume that there were a number of weeks that between the time of Job's first and second test before these men were able to get there. I mean, it just makes sense. I mean, it would take a while for news to travel, you know, of what had taken place with Job. It would take them a while to kind of get together and coordinate. I mean, they didn't have cell phones. They probably didn't even do smoke signals. I don't know how they did it. But it's going to take them a while to communicate and make it and decide how they're going to do these things. And then to actually then make the trip, to travel. So, I mean, there's most likely a number of weeks that would have passed before they actually arrived and able to see Job. We see that when they do see Job, they don't recognize him. The physical pain, the emotional suffering that he is enduring have obviously taken a severe toll on his physical appearance. And so they cannot even recognize this guy, this man, their friend. And so it says they weep out loud when they see him. And so they're clearly moved by what their friend is going through as they just see him sitting there. Next, it says that they tear their robes, they throw dust on their heads. This was probably a cultural expressions of identifying with someone who was in great grief and pain and basically saying, you know, we're with you in this. You know, we want to come alongside you in this. Now, in all this, Job says nothing. Job says nothing. And so, therefore, they sit down and they say nothing for 7 days. Now, a couple things that this tells you. First off, this tells you they did not come by with the intention of just dropping by, saying hello, and then going back home, make sure he's okay. They came with the intention of walking through this trial with him. I mean, that was their intention. So they come and they just sit and they're with him for 7 days. That was their intention, to walk through the trial with him. Secondly, I don't consider myself a big talker. My wife, I think, could verify that. But to think of sitting for 7 days and saying nothing, I mean, that would be, if you can even think back to last Sunday, that would mean between then and now, you would have said nothing. All day, all night, in the same place, and said nothing. You guys have all talked a lot in the last 7 days. They said nothing. And once again, they were empathizing with Job. Job was saying nothing. So they just sit there with him. Now, this would probably be an uncomfortable silence. Obviously, it's uncomfortable for Job. I mean, my guess is Job's probably not sleeping very much. I mean, he's in agony. I mean, he's not going to be able to get comfortable. He's going to sleep very little. So I am assuming there's probably all kinds of moans and groans coming from Job often through the night, all the time. And these guys just sit with him. Now, we're going to see as the book goes on that Job's friends ultimately fail to be the comfort that they apparently intended to be when they came there. But in their early actions, we really do get a good example of some things that we might be able to learn from ourselves, you know, in trying to be a comfort to someone, especially if we're going through a kind of a very difficult time and time of mourning and grieving. I thought this was an interesting quote that Joseph Carle made about the fact of the silence. And really, in the sense, he's saying this is something we can learn from these, from Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. He says, when a man is resolved to mourn, let him mourn. Your advice may anger, but it will not help him. Let sorrow have its way a while, and that will make way for comfort. It's real tempting, and this is very tempting for me, is to give advice to somebody when they're not even looking for it. I mean, they're just hurting. That's the way things are, just what kind of the situation they're in. And probably giving advice early on in that kind of situation, they're not going to be able to profit from it anyway. But there'll come a time where that will be an appropriate thing to do. So I think there's some examples here of just kind of empathizing and kind of being there and being a help to people, friends, who are going through difficult times. Now, at the end of the 7 days is when Job speaks. And that brings us to the second main point that we're going to consider this morning. Job breaks his prolonged silence with a lament, cursing the day of his birth. So, I'll read here Job chapter 3. Afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. Let the stars of his twilight be darkened. Let it wait for light, but have none. And let it not see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth? Come forth from the womb and expire. Why did the knees receive me? Why the breast that I should suck? For now I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept then. I would have been at rest with kings and with counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who were filling their house with silver, or like a miscarriage which is discarded. I would not be as infants that never saw the light. Therefore the wicked cease from raging, and there the The weary are at rest. The prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the voice of their taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who suffers, and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but there is none, and dig for it more than hidden treasures, who rejoice greatly and exult when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? For my groaning comes at the sight of my food, and my cries pour out like water. For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet, but I am not at rest, but turmoil comes. Probably the first word that comes to mind in reading that is shocking. Job has expressed amazing faith after the first two tests. And now, several weeks after those tragic things have occurred, we see Job cursing the day of his birth. Now, he doesn't curse God. He never does that. But he does curse the day of his birth. Now, this is where the poetry section of the book of Job begins. And the very fact that it's written in poetry really makes these words of Job even more vivid because of the pictures and so forth that he uses. But more specifically, this particular chapter would be called a lament. Laments really were quite common in the Bible. You can find probably more than 60 of them in the Psalms themselves. And laments were used to help a person express their struggles. It was to help them express suffering and even their disappointment to the Lord. That's what a lament was for. That's what they used it for. It was there was kind of a deep, honest, just real fervor that the person would express in this lament and try to express the distress that they're feeling. So let's look at the three different aspects of Job's lament. Three aspects here of Job's lament. First aspect of it is in verses 1 through 10, really verses 3 through 10. He wishes he had never been born. What we see here is Job expressing an unbearable anguish and sorrow. He's overwhelmed with how horrible life can be. He's overcome with depression. I don't think you really see anger here. But what you do see is pain and no way out of that pain. He pronounces a curse on something that cannot be changed, his birth. So he says if only he had never been born or even conceived in the first place, that's what he wishes would have happened. Now, it's interesting. Job was apparently familiar with the creation story of Genesis 1. He makes a deliberate play on words, kind of a counterexample to when God said, "Let there be light," in Genesis 1, in creation. And if you look at verses 3 and 4, you can see this play on light, he's talking about darkness. Well, I'll start with verse 3. Let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness. Let not God care above care for it, nor let light shine on it. And then he continues with the theme of darkness in verses 5 and 6. Let the darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize it. And then down in verse 9. Let the stars of its twilight be darkened. Let it wait for light, but have none. Let it not see the breaking dawn. So he uses just the picture here of darkness as far as the day of his birth. He even kind of ties in the day when he was actually conceived. He seems to kind of go back and forth in talking about that. In verse 7, he says, it would be better off if my mother was barren. In verse 8, he refers to Leviathan. Don't know exactly what that is. Seems to have been a great sea creature of some sort, possibly a dragon or even a dinosaur, possibly, could be referred to here. But what he seems to be alluding to is talking about soothsayers and talking about calling up Leviathan so Leviathan could swallow the day on which he was conceived or the day that he was born. And so you just see these feelings of just anguish. You know, I wish I was never born. And just all these pictures that he draws on how what he wishes that day would be like. Just darkness, just nothing. Wish it was just didn't never even happened. Now, what's interesting is the prophet Jeremiah prayed a very similar prayer. I think it might be good to read this. It's in Jeremiah chapter 20, verses 14 through 18. And once again, this will be a lament that the prophet Jeremiah is speaking, praying. He says, "Cursed be the day when I was born. Let the day not be blessed when my mother bore me. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, saying, 'A baby boy has been born to you,' and made him very happy. But let that man be like the cities which the Lord overthrew without relenting, and let him hear an outcry in the morning and a shout of alarm at noon, because he did not kill me before birth, so that my mother would have been my grave, and her womb never pregnant. Why did I ever come forth from their womb to look on trouble and sorrow, so that my days have been spent in shame?" Jeremiah was called to be a prophet of the Lord, and as a result of his ministry, he endured significant rejection, not just from the people, but even from his friends. And so as a result, he too is in deep sorrow, deep trouble, and he prays similar, almost the exact same prayer that Job expresses, this lament, wishing he'd never been born. Job moves from wishing he had never been born to the section in verses 11 through 19. In this section, he wishes his mother had had a miscarriage. He begins this section with two questions, verse 11 and 12. "Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, and why the breast that I should suck?" So, if the day of his conception or the day of his birth cannot be cursed, he now wishes that if he had to be born, that he would have died at birth. Either through his mother having a miscarriage or that her breast would not have milk so that he would not be able to nurse and that he would just be allowed to die. Now, it's interesting. He thinks of death as a time where he was just going to be able to rest. Obviously, he's not resting at all now from almost every angle you can think of. Look at verse 13. He says, "For now I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept then. I would have been at rest." It's just the idea the pain would be over. It would not, I would just be at rest. It would be gone. You've probably heard people talk like that. You know, if they're near death or going through extreme suffering, just wish it was over. Well, that's how Job is feeling. He just wished that it was over. In light of the fact that he is like an outcast now, sitting out in the ashes in the city dump, he also sees death as something of an equalizer because it's going to happen to everyone. And picking up in verse 14, actually the end of verse 13, says, "I will have been at rest with kings and with counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold or were filling their house with silver, or like a miscarriage which is discarded, I would not be as infants that never saw the light. There the wicked cease from raging, and there the weary are at rest. The prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master." So he mentions several different classifications of people. Kings, wealthy princes, an infant who had never been born, miscarried, which he was thinking, he was wishing that was the category he was in. Prisoners, slaves, the small, the great, they're all on the same level when they die. It says they're all, you know, equal in the sense at death because they all die. Now, Job is not even considering the issue of heaven or hell here. That's not even in the picture. He's not even thinking about that. All he's thinking of is, I want relief from the pain and the rest that will come in death. Then in verses 20 to 26, we see this further aspect of Job's lament. He wishes that all who suffer might be permitted to die quickly. He starts this section with questions as well, starting in verse 20. "Why is light given to him who suffers, and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but there is none? They dig for it more than hidden treasure, who rejoice greatly and exult when they find the grave." So And then verse 23. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? So basically he's asking, why are those who suffer and are continuing to suffer, why aren't they allowed to die instead of keep on living? That's really what he's asking. Why do they keep on living? They don't want to keep on living. They want to die. And of course, he's speaking of himself. Especially here, God's not going to answer this question. He says, well, why are they given light? And really, then he explains later, he means, why are they given life while they're bitter of life? And they don't want that. The last few verses of the chapter really further describe Job's distress. If you look at 24 and 25, he says, my groaning comes at the sight of my food. My cries pour out like water, for what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. It's interesting there in verse 24, New American Standard says, my groaning comes out at the sight of food. My cries pour out like water. Those words could be better translated with words like yelling, bellowing, roaring. Some of that word is sometimes used to describe the roaring of a lion. It seems like the translators want to kind of tone down the words a little bit. Job's just not kind of mumbling to himself or just kind of being quiet. He's actually yelling these things. I mean, he's bellowing out these things. Verse 26 really sums up his condition. He says, I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I'm yelling. I'm not at rest. Turmoil comes. So what do we make of all this? Well, I want to close with four lessons, I think, that we can consider from this. First off, I think we need to see this. Laments have a legitimate place in the Christian's prayer life. As I mentioned, there are over 60 laments in the Psalms. One of the commentators was saying that the very fact that the church used to be more familiar with laments because most of the church would sing psalms more regularly. The hymn book that we're considering has a number of Psalter hymns in it from the Psalter. But he's saying the fact that psalms aren't sung very much, which means laments aren't sung very much. So when we hear something of a lament, it's like, what's this all about? You don't read those kind of things. But then, and I don't know that there's any laments, there's probably one that would be similar in tone, because you really don't see really any hope in chapter 3. And so you can imagine, I've never heard anybody try to put Job 3 to music. You know, I wish I was never born. I wish I had died at birth. Why doesn't everybody who suffered just die? You know, I just don't think that'd be good to sing together, probably. But those things are in the Scripture. And it's a legitimate prayer that Job is praying. It feels kind of horrifying. I mean, how could a godly man like Job, and we read what Jeremiah prayed, how could they say such a thing? Well, I think the very fact that it's here in the Bible tells us there are times in our lives, and we probably hope they don't happen often, but there are times in our lives where a lament is an appropriate prayer to pray. God doesn't answer Job's questions, but neither does God seem to be threatened by Job's questions. Job doesn't get the answers he wants, but it's interesting too that God doesn't abandon him for asking the questions, especially in this time that he's going through. The one answer that God does give much later in the latter chapters of the book of Job is basically that God will be glorified no matter what. Job can be assured of that, that God will be glorified no matter what. Well, that doesn't answer all the detailed questions, but that is comfort. And that is a wonderful truth, that no matter what you're feeling, no matter what's happening, no matter what you're going through, God will and always is glorified. And that's a good thing. So lesson number one, just simply this. I think laments have a legitimate place in the Christian's prayer life. Number two, though Job wanted to die because of his submission to God's sovereignty over life, He never considered suicide. It's clear, we've made it clear. I mean, this, he doesn't want to live anymore. He said that in a number of different ways. Verse 21, he speaks of those who long for death, but there is none. And of course, he's talking about himself. He's longing for death. He wants to die, but he never once even suggests that he wants to kill himself. I mean, you could see where that would be a kind of a logical step to take. I want to die. I wish I'd never been born. I wish all people who suffered could die like me. But he never takes the step of, I want to take my own life. I want to kill myself. He never takes that step. I think that's an important boundary to consider. If you're praying a lament, for example, that part doesn't come in. How is it that he can do that? Why is it that he does not go there when it would seem a natural place to go? Well, I think it goes back to Job's fundamental understanding of who his God is and what his relationship to God is. He's really not, I mean, he knows God is good. He knows he's wise. He knows he's sovereign over all things. Now, those things really aren't being expressed in chapter 3, but we saw them in chapter 2, chapters 1 and 2. And so even though he's not expressing that, there is a ground level foundation in Job's life so that he knows that God is the one who gives life and God is the one who takes life, and Job does not have the right or the authority to do that himself. It's just there. He just knows that. And so he doesn't go there. That's not even an option. So he's expressing this lament, this desire, wishing he was dead, but he stops short and never even considers, apparently, at least from what's written here, the idea of committing suicide. I think that's an important lesson to consider. There's a definite distinction there. There may come times in your life or my life where we have the same kind of desire, wishing we were dead, but we must never forget the time of our death is in God's hands and not ours. Lesson number 3. Job's greatest fear was connected with his greatest treasure, a vital relationship with the Lord. This is verse 25. He says, "For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me." I think there's an important truth kind of said, and I think in some ways implied in this verse. But let me first tell you how this verse is sometimes wrongly interpreted. Some of you may have heard this, the interpretation, depending on what kind of things you might have read or listened to on the radio. But there are those who would follow, I'm not even sure how best to describe it, the word faith movement, the word faith theology, a way of believing, which basically says, really, what you confess with your mouth is what you get. If you confess bad things, you get bad things. If you confess good things, you get good things in your life. And it's your expression of your faith. You're expressing, you know, what you believe, and whatever comes out of your mouth is what you get. It's based on your confession. And that would be the explanation behind the good things and the bad things that happen in your life. It would have to do with where your faith is and what you confess, what you speak. That's the explanation for why these things happen. They would say that this verse is the explanation behind the bad things that happened to Job. The reason is not the sovereignty of God. The reason is Job's fear. Because what Job feared came upon him. And we know, at least in part, that he spoke out some words that expressed some of that fear. I'll read it for you. Back in chapter 1, verse 5, he's talking about his children and how he would offer sacrifices on their behalf. The last part of verse 5, Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. That's apparently a fear that Job had, and he spoke it out loud. It's his mistake. Shouldn't speak it out loud. And so, this interpretation would basically say Job was afraid the Sabaeans would attack him, therefore they did. Job was afraid the Chaldeans would attack, and they did. He was afraid something would happen to his children, that's why they died. He was afraid that he would get a serious disease, and so he did. It's what you fear that comes upon you. I mean, that's how this explanation would go, something along that line. I think there's a better explanation than that. I think this book tells us what Job feared. Once again, the verse says, "What I fear comes upon me. What I dread befalls me." What does Job fear? We've already seen what Job fears. There are three times, chapter 1, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 8, and chapter 2, verse 3, we are told three times that Job feared God. And then even that verse I just we read in chapter 1, verse 5. His fear was that his children would curse God. So what is it that Job feared? He feared God. There was a reverence, there was a submission, there was a true worship of God in his life. That's what was there. That was his life. Was his worship and his reverence and his submissive fear of God. Well, what did he want more than anything else for his children? That they would fear God too. That's what all Christians want for their children, is that their children would fear God, that they would have that same worship, that same reverence for God. And so it's obvious that the greatest treasure in Job's life was God, his relationship with God. That's what he valued more than anything else. And one thing that we will see, that you can see, and if you think about this in your own life, I think there's a connection here. What we treasure the most, what we most value, is generally connected with what we fear the most, because we're afraid of losing it, because it's so important. That's our treasure. That's what we value. That's what we love more than anything else. So our biggest fears are connected oftentimes with what we treasure the most. Job feared losing that close relationship with God that he had had for the overwhelming majority of his life. That was by far the most important thing in his life, and now he feels distant from God. I mean, the sorrow of the great losses in his life, the extreme physical pain he was enduring, not understanding what's happening, there's still a trust of God there. But that sense of God's presence obviously is not there like it used to be. So what he feared has come upon him. That losing that sense of the presence of God, that's where he is now. And that's actually something I think that we're going to see is a major issue as we continue on through the book of Job. He just doesn't know. He still trusts God, but he just can't sense the presence. He doesn't know exactly what's going on. There's a wrestling there, because he doesn't see it like he used to. So he's feared that. So what he feared the most had come upon him, but he had not lost the Lord. He just lost the sense of his presence, because he's still in the Lord's hands. We're going to look at that in this next point. But he's lost that sense of it. Once again, the lesson here, I think, is for us to make a connection ourselves. You may want to take a little journey within yourself and think, what is it that you fear the most? You probably don't have to think very hard, because you probably know some things that you fear quite a bit. Well, make a connection. How does that tie in with what you treasure the most? That may be encouraging to you. That may be a trouble sign, because maybe you treasure things more highly than you should. And those are the reasons that your fears are like they are. So there's a lesson here, I think, that we can learn from Job, because I think his treasure was in the right place, and therefore I think his fear was in the right place. One final lesson to point out. It's only by God's grace that Job or anyone else is enabled to hold on to their faith in the face of trials. This is verse 23 I want to mention. Job says, "Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in?" He says his way is hidden. He can't understand what's happening. He has lots of questions. He doesn't have answers. And he speaks of being hedged in by God. And he recognizes that God has hedged him in the sense, and that even though he's suffering greatly, he can't die. He wants to die. That's what the theme of the whole chapter is. But he senses he's hedged. He feels trapped. He's having to suffer. He can't die. He's hedged in. His way is hedged in. Now, you're going to make a connection here because that idea of hedge has already come up in Job 1 and 2. Remember, that's what Satan complained about. You've got his way all hedged in. I can't get to him. Whether it's his stuff, whether it's his body, his health, you've got his way hedged in. He was hedged in. And we talked about that's the idea of Job is in the hand of God. And therefore, Satan could not get to Job except what God permitted. Well, Job's still in the hand of God. And what he's recognizing here is his physical life is being hedged in. He's still living. He's in extreme suffering, but he can't die. And he feels hedged in. Well, that's true. He is. But I think it's more. The idea of being in the hand of God, being hedged in by God, is more than just having your physical being protected or watched over in some way. It's that being in the hand of God that keeps your faith alive, that keeps your faith going. It's not just a physical hedge. It's a spiritual hedge around our very soul, around our very existence, that we can continue to we can believe God at all and continue to believe Him. Because it's really by God's grace that Job ever feared God to begin with. And it's by God's grace that as he has come through these earlier tests, he's able to say, "Bless your name, Lord," in spite of what's going on. That was the grace of God that was enabling him because he was still in God's hands and he still is in God's hand. It reminds me of a picture in the book Pilgrim's Progress. Christian, who's the main character, is traveling. He comes to the interpreter's house. Interpreter's house has all these different rooms in it. Every room has something that illustrates a certain truth about the Christian life. One room, he looks in and he sees a fire burning against the wall. Seems to be something like a fireplace. A fire burning against the wall, and there's somebody with buckets of water trying to put the fire out. And then interpreter takes him around to look at the back of the wall. The fire won't go out. He's looking around the back of the wall, and there's a man behind the wall pouring oil on the fire. Secretly. You can't see him. He's behind the scenes. So what's the point? Well, interpreter tells him, here's what the point is. The fire is the work of God's grace in the heart of every Christian. Satan is the one who's continually trying to douse it, trying to put it out through the trials and temptations he brings into our life. So how is it that it's not put out? It's because Christ is constantly pouring oil on the fire, keeping it going. A lot of times you're not even aware. Most of the time you're not even aware of what He's doing to keep your faith alive. But He is. And that's our hope. That's what Job's hope was, that he would continue because he was hedged in. He was watched over by God. He is in the hand of God. And he's continuing to keep his faith alive, not just his body, but his faith alive. Same thing is true for you. I want to close with this. It's a quote, but actually it's a blessing that William Henry Green wrote, especially in relation to this chapter. He says, "May he whose grace supported Job in all his dreadful trials hitherto grant like grace to us, grace according to our need, grace to do according to the measure of the task required of us, grace to bear according to the measure of the burden laid upon us, and to his name be praise. Amen." Lord, we want to thank you.